For the past 2 years, Myanmar has recorded the most deaths and injuries from landmines and explosive remnants of war of any country in the world. In 2024, reported casualties more than doubled from the previous year, in statistics that assuredly undercount the devastation caused by these terrible weapons. Although Myanmar had already seen decades of landmine contamination, since the 2021 coup and subsequent conflict, there's been a sharp increase in the deadly and indiscriminate use of anti-personnel mines, with children and other civilians suffering the consequences. People are being maimed and killed in the course of their daily lives, shattering families and disrupting livelihoods, with a persistent threat that could last generations. Insight Myanmar's in-depth series titled Navigating a Minefield explores the situation on the ground, impacts on survivors and communities, and humanitarian mine action making a difference at the local, national, and international levels. We are joining a network of independent news media publishing in Burmese, ethnic language, and English, both in Myanmar and in the diaspora, to raise awareness about the dangers of landmines and explosive remnants of war, as well as action that can save lives and support community leadership. More information about the series is available on the Insight Myanmar website under the Mine Action section. Today, we are joined by Dr. Stuart Casey Maslin. He is one of the world's leading legal experts on landmines, disarmament, and international humanitarian law. His career, as we will learn in the upcoming interview, has spanned work with ICRC, UNICEF, the Geneva Academy, Norwegian People's Aid, Landmine Monitor, and Mine Action Review, and he has written extensively on the Mine Ban Treaty. He joins us on this episode to help us unpack what international law can and cannot do in the face of Myanmar's devastating landmine crisis. So with that introduction, Dr. Casey Maslin, thank you so much for joining us on this critical topic.
Thanks very much for having me.
So before we get into the issues of Myanmar, landmines, and the law, I'd like to start a bit with your own path into this work, because your career has moved across international law, humanitarian action, disarmament, treaty negotiation, mine action, and academic scholarship. And so I'm curious, how did that happen originally? What drew you into the world of landmines and weapons law, and why did this become the field you stayed with?
Well, I did back in 92 to 93, I did a master's in international human rights law. And one of the parts of that master's was international humanitarian law, or the law of armed conflict, as it's probably better known. And I was very lucky. I studied under Professor Françoise Hampson, sadly no longer with us. But she was an inspirational figure. And at the end of the master's, the opportunity came up to support what was then the beginning of a campaign against landmines. And I was sent hundreds of pages of documents over a weekend. I spent the entire weekend reading through them. And at the end of it, I said to myself and to others, how is it that these weapons are still lawful? And from that was the next three decades of work on landmines. So it was a chance kind of encounter as a result of Professor Hampson's commitment and her contacts and shock at what landmines were doing to, obviously, individuals first and foremost, but more broadly to societies and communities.
Right. And I think for many listening, they would share your sense of when we get deeper into stories around the use of landmines in the world today, there is this real sense of moral outrage at play here, and it's very justified. But in this conversation, I want us to try to move beyond that outrage and into these legal and technical details that, as your career would advance onto from that initial shock, and bring our listeners there as well, and determine what can be proven, what can be prosecuted, and what international law can actually reach in this regard. And this is because without that precision, even justified anger, it just ends up blurring the very distinctions that matter most with this. What's morally abhorrent, what's legally prohibited, what can be documented, and then, you know, what can actually be brought into a courtroom. So first off, I want to slow down and just clarify the devices themselves we're talking about. And this is because landmines can come off as a kind of catch-all word, but legally and technically, as I've gotten more into the subject matter, not all explosive devices are the same. There are anti-personnel landmines. These are designed to explode from the presence, proximity, or contact of a person. There are anti-vehicle mines. These are aimed at vehicles rather than people. There are improvised explosive devices. Some of these might be victim-activated and function like landmines, while others are command detonated by someone choosing the moment of attack. There are booby traps. These go by homes, paths, or civilian spaces. They then turn by triggers. And then there's explosive remnants of war, especially unexploded ordnance where shells, bombs, rockets, or other munitions that failed to explode when first used, these remain deadly afterwards. And I go into all this detail to start this conversation because these distinctions aren't just technicalities. They're shaping whether we're talking about a banned weapon, an indiscriminate attack, a problem of attribution, a failure to protect civilians, or just a different legal category altogether. So before we move into the side of the law itself, I wanted to ask you to correct or complete the basic map I laid out. And are there major categories of explosive devices or distinctions that you'd like to help clarify that? And why is it so important to get this matter right when we're trying to understand not just the harm, but the responsibility behind it? And ultimately, what can be done with this accountability?
Yeah, you've characterized it very well. I just start from the fundamental point that any landmine, whether it's anti-personnel mine or an anti-vehicle mine, the feature of that weapon is that it is activated, detonated by the victim. And it is designed to be detonated by the victim. That's the key feature of a landmine. It's, of course, an explosive device, and you've given a number of different types of explosive device, but it's that victim-activated nature that means a weapon is potentially a landmine and not some other munition. There are, of course, just as you rightly said, we talk about unexploded ordnance or explosive remnants of war. These are munitions, so explosive munitions, that have failed to detonate as intended. So it's the failure of a munition to detonate on hitting the ground or a tank or whatever it may be that then makes them dangerous. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that they're not deadly for civilians, because they are, but it is the failure of a munition as opposed to the design feature. And it's this particularly pernicious element of design that means even if the combatants, the soldier, puts the mine against a military objective when they originally lay them, because these weapons can stay effective for months, years, decades, it is very unlikely that after all that time, the victim will actually be a lawful military target. It will be a civilian. It could be a woman. It could be a child. It could be an adult male civilian. But it is very unlikely to be a soldier.
And so then as we move into the ways that we're looking at what the specific type of explosive is and the harm that it causes, if we start with this category of victim-activated weapons, in international law, what is it that makes this sense of victim activation so important? What changes legally when a device is triggered not by a person choosing the moment of attack, but rather by the victim's presence, proximity, or contact?
So one of the problems is clearly there is a deliberate delay between the placing of the mine and the detonation. When you fire a gun, when you fire a missile, when you launch a rocket or fire a shell, your impact is going to be seconds or minutes. And therefore, you are targeting, rightly or wrongly, somebody or something. You can then be held accountable if you've targeted a civilian or a civilian object and you've done it deliberately. That's a war crime. You can be held accountable. If you put a mine in the ground, it may be years before that mine detonates. And as I mentioned earlier, it's unlikely to be a lawful military target that is detonated. How then do you hold the person who placed that mine accountable? It becomes much more difficult. And the reality is, when you look at the statistics, yes, in the middle of battlefields and ongoing conflicts, then it may well be the case that more soldiers are killed or injured than civilians. But over the lifespan of the weapon, it is the case that it is civilians who are going to be the majority of the victims. And it is communities that pay the price because they can't sow their crops, because they can't graze their livestock, and so on. So you don't just have the horrible personal impact, you also have that broader community, societal, and economic impact. And it's for that reason that we banned anti-personnel mines.
I want to get next into the legality issues that that we look at. Again, a very complex field of many overlapping and sometimes conflicting legal frameworks to be able to come to an understanding with. Before we do, I want to ask a question that just kind of brings a layman's understanding into the work you do, because as I framed the beginning of this conversation, there can be this very justified moral outrage upon hearing this. Indeed, this is what you describe, having gotten yourself into the field, and many of us that are very concerned about Myanmar and seeing the prevalence of landmines there, that it's something that can motivate and enrage us. And then with these legal frameworks, there could be a sense from an outsider's point of view that one is splitting hairs on the correct and justified ways to cause tremendous human harm that would be within or outside a legal framework. And I intentionally phrase that a little provocatively, because I understand as we get into the legality of this, these things can't be decided and determined by moral outrage alone. There needs to be obviously some clear laws with it. But did it take some time for you as you were starting to come to the legal understandings in how to separate the reality and the emotional response to that reality with a very specific and objective kind of legal framework that is ultimately describing in great detail every aspect of that a law would do as to how essentially humans are allowed to harm other humans and when they're not?
So there is a view out there, and it's still a view that I occasionally hear from time to time, is war is horrible. You can't make it more humane. It's just what it is. And we know that's the way it's always been. That is not a view I subscribe to. And I don't think that's a view that is correct on the facts. Why not? Because we go back thousands of years and we see that there were restrictions on which weapons could be used in warfare. Restrictions in the earliest times on the use of poison, for example. Later, restrictions on the use of the crossbow, for example. And if we move into the modern times, restrictions on the type of bullets that you can use. That's the basis of humanitarian law. It's accepting that there is violence, severe, significant violence, that people are killed, people are injured, but that there are also some limits that can be imposed. Because if you don't, your logical conclusion is biological weapons are okay, chemical weapons are okay, nuclear weapons are okay, bullets that explode when they hit a person's body are okay. And thankfully, international law has worked to try and limit that. And if we stick just with the question of anti-personnel mines, I can say to you with absolute confidence that there are tens of thousands of people who have arms and legs that would not have had them if we didn't have the prohibition on anti-personnel mines. Now, I appreciate that does not cover the case of Myanmar, but it does cover many other countries around the world. And our hope, of course, is that Myanmar and the other countries that remain outside the convention will join. That doesn't stop war. That doesn't stop the sufferings of war. What it does is protect some civilians from traumatic amputation and death.
That's an incredible answer. I really appreciate the historical background of it. It's incredible to think of previous centuries where crossbows and poisons and different things were, even in the act of killing your enemy, that there was a way to think about this kind of conflict of what was and wasn't permissible. And the follow-up question to that is, I also wonder about when in general, international humanitarian law principles, and I appreciate this wide-ranging global as well as historical view that you bring to it, which I think then centers us back as we get into Myanmar. There could be a sense in looking from outside that if one is trying to win a battle where, you know, and when it's conflict, the stakes are obviously already inherently high by definition, that it's hard for me to get in the mind of a combatant thinking, well, this is literally a life or death struggle, but we have to abide by these principles in order to win it, and those principles we can't. I mean, I'm thinking of the expression right now as I say that, all is fair in love and war. And I know that one of the things that treaties try to do is to create a sense of a culture or sensibility, and we'll get into that later too as to where that comes into Myanmar. But what can you tell us about where in some of these highest stakes that are possible, where it is literally life and death, where you're doing anything to try to have your side prevail and possibly even the survival of your perceived survival of your own community, where there has been some success in getting into the psyche of realizing, well, yes, we have to do everything we can to succeed, but actually not everything, these things we actually can't do.
And that's why we moved into a body of law called disarmament law, because we accepted that the law of armed conflict, which regulates the use of weapons, was probably not, in most cases, going to be adequate to prevent their use. What do I mean by that? Well, if you have weapons in front of you and you are in a desperate situation, the temptation to use those weapons, even if they are unlawful, even if their use is banned by the law of armed conflict, that temptation is going to be strong. That's why we had initially a prohibition on chemical weapons in 1899. We had a new prohibition or a reaffirmation of the prohibition in 1925. After 50 million chemical shells were fired in the First World War. And it took the Chemical Weapons Convention, where you stop production, where you destroy stockpiles, where you prohibit development, where you prohibit transfer. It took all of those disarmament obligations to make the use of chemical weapons almost non-existent. And I do stress the word almost, because as we know, international law is not perfect. There are exceptions. But again, there are many tens of thousands of people who are alive today because of the prohibition of chemical weapons in a disarmament treaty. And that's why when it came to anti-personnel mines, they were not prohibited by IHL. There was no existing prohibition. So there were two choices. Could we just prohibit use, as some people said, or should we go for a full disarmament prohibition? And I'm very glad that states took the decision to go for a full disarmament prohibition.
fascinating. And with that background, I now want to move into what we're looking at in this topic at hand. So, which you are one of the most relevant people to speak to about this, because you have been involved in almost every part of these iterations. We have the Mindban Treaty or the Ottawa Treaty. We have the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, broader international humanitarian law, IHL, which we've referenced, customary law, criminal accountability, and then mechanisms like Geneva Call. This is for non-state armed groups. And again, I don't want to turn this conversation into an encyclopedia of international law, but I do think it's important to help sketch out the basics now that we've established where law comes in to attempt to govern parts of armed conflict, and which frameworks are mattering most here. What does each one do, I think, might be good to look into. And most importantly, how do these distinctions between some of the protocols I've just named before, how do they shape what accountability can realistically look like? Like, what can be documented, what can be alleged, what can be prosecuted, and where then the law also reaches its limits?
Sure. Well, if you'll permit me, I'll go through a little bit of the history, which I think will explain how we've got to where we are today with respect to landmines. In the 1970s, there was a widespread understanding that we needed to add new laws in the new rules in the law of armed conflict. We have the Geneva Conventions from 1949, which reflected to a large extent the experience of the Second World War, but actually those Geneva Conventions focus on the treatment of detainees, the treatment of prisoners of war, civilians in occupied territory. They didn't regulate weapons. And as the decades went by and there were attempts to regulate weapons, in particular to prohibit nuclear weapons, but also to look at other explosive weapons, there was a sense that we needed to go further. And this led to the negotiation of the additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions. The problem was you had a strong movement, not on landmines, but on napalm. People were seeing the use of napalm in the Vietnam War, and a number of governments led by Sweden said, in these new protocols, we need to ban napalm. They came up against the United States, which was adamant that they needed to continue to use napalm in their military operations. And this debate got so toxic that the Red Cross and states were worried that they weren't actually going to get the additional protocols. So what did they decide to do? They said, well, let's take out all the weapon-specific stuff from those protocols. Let's adopt the protocols and let's give the UN the task of regulating specific conventional weapons. And there was the genesis of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. There were initially three protocols, the first which banned the weapon that didn't exist, the second which addressed landmines, and the third which addressed incendiary weapons, particularly napalm. The ban that several states wanted on incendiary weapons didn't happen, and the protocol on landmines was actually not very controversial. People still had this view that mines were laid in ordinary patterns, they were fenced, they were marked, and all the kind of protections you could expect to see to minimize the risk to civilians. The problem is, as that protocol was being drafted, we were already seeing landmines being used by non-state armed groups, in particular, in an anarchic fashion, in an attempt to target civilians or not caring whether civilians were targeted. And as the 80s went on, we saw the situation in Cambodia, we saw the situation in Afghanistan, and there was an understanding that the existing law, which applied to regular armed forces and not to non-state armed groups, which foresaw a logical, professional army placing, mapping, recording, and so on, that just wasn't the world in which we were living. And therefore, there was a call prompted by an NGO now called Humanity and Inclusion that we needed to review that protocol. And many NGOs then came together and said, actually, in reviewing that protocol, we need a ban. it is only a prohibition on the use of anti-personnel mines that is going to really protect civilians. As tens of thousands were losing their legs, I mentioned Afghanistan, Cambodia, those were the two most dramatic examples, but there were plenty of others, Angola and Yemen and so on. The attempt to get that prohibition within the United Nations was unsuccessful. There was a new protocol called Amended Protocol 2 to the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. It tightened restrictions. It required self-destruct features to minimize the risk to civilians. But it was clear that this was not going to be enough. And at that point, Canada stepped in and said, states that want to ban this weapon, come to Ottawa in the autumn of 1996, and we're going to talk about how to get that ban. And it was on that basis that we ended up with the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention, because it was understood that we needed a total prohibition to include development, production, stockpiling, and transfer. And it is that convention that, as I said, has saved tens of thousands of lives and limbs, sadly not in Myanmar.
Again, an incredible historical backdrop that you give us to know where we got today. And just a little tidbit in that process, I seem to remember that this monumental Ottawa Treaty, this became an issue that was quite important to Lady Diana. In what ways was she involved, and did her involvement and her celebrity and status at that time, do you see that making some kind of real difference in that process, or was it just more the media attention of a figure of her stature?
She certainly publicized it, her walking through an area that had been cleared in Angola by a leading demining organization, the Halo Trust. That certainly had a big impact. It was extremely important for the campaign. In terms of turning the dial, I think when we got to Oslo in September of 1997, there were already enough states that wanted to ban this weapon. Where I think it did have a significant impact is in constraining the ability of the United Kingdom to side with the US and carve out exceptions, because they would have been seen to have torpedoed what some people were calling Diana's treaty. So she certainly had an impact, but I think already, I think part of that was mobilization, and part of that already there were many states that were dedicated to banning the weapon.
And you also mentioned that at this time, when there was this groundswell of momentum, that it was Canada that really stepped into that to want to capitalize on that momentum and bring it to the finish line. And we've had some Canadian guests on our podcast working in Mine Action who reference a sense of pride in carrying on that legacy. I'm also curious, just to better understand the historical record, what impetus would you attribute to Canada specifically in this issue being something that they wanted to take on as closely as they did, to the extent that the Mine Ban Treaty is also known as the Ottawa Treaty?
There's good and bad in this story. And the good is certainly that Canada grabbed the metal, that they launched this process, and then that the then Foreign Minister of Canada, Lord Axworthy, was bold enough and courageous enough to say, we want you at this conference, we want you all to come back next year and sign a treaty banning anti-personnel mines. He shocked governments, he shocked the French, he shocked the British with that. That was a courageous decision, and I applaud him for it. Where the story gets a bit less positive for Canada is at the Oslo conference. As we were negotiating a treaty, the US had come on board very late. They'd come on board with a series of red lines that frankly were ludicrous. They didn't have a flexibility in their negotiating position, which made it very difficult for other states to accommodate them. And they did want to try and accommodate them. Having the US on board would have been extremely good. So we come to the last few days of the conference. We're very close to an agreement, but the US hasn't got those red lines. They then put a little bit of pressure on Canada, and you have the Canadian Prime Minister phoning round government saying, oh, you need to side with the United States. That, I think, is what cost Lord Axworthy what otherwise would have been a very justified Nobel Peace Prize. And what we saw is, in particular, developing nations, in particular, the global South, African nations and Central American nations, showing the moral courage to say, no, these weapons are going to be banned. It's up to you, the US, to come on board. There was a famous conversation when President Clinton called up President Mandela to say, Mr. Mandela, your chair of the conference needs to show more flexibility. And President Mandela, a remarkable human being, said, actually, no, Mr. President, it's the United States that needs to show more flexibility. He backed his person. He didn't back down. He stayed on the moral side of the argument. Sadly, the US walked away. That is regrettable. But the reality is they've only used anti-personnel mines once since that time. This has not been a weapon that has been integral to US operations. So what I think that shows is you can continue to fight wars without having to use anti-personnel mines and without putting the lives and limbs of civilians at risk.
I so appreciate hearing the details of how we got to where we were today. And when you call out the United States for where it was hesitating and certainly not leading the way, if anything, dragging its feet and creating obstacles, it's... you know, we hear a lot today about some of where the rules-based global order is starting to show, is starting to frail and starting to fracture. And but when we look at where it's fracturing today, we often see the late 90s or so as the high watermark. And, you know, certainly the Clinton era of U.S. presidents as in many cases of this being where it was at its highest. And so it could appear somewhat contradictory to think that that in the case of the Ottawa Treaty, where there was so much momentum and so much support from the and so much willingness from the Global South, that it would be the U.S. at that time and Clinton that would be that would be the roadblock for it. So, what were the circumstances around which they that the United States was just very hesitant about where this treaty was going?
As I understand it, Clinton had said to a number of people, I couldn't go against the Joint Chiefs of Staff on this one. But I'm not sure that that really tells the whole story. The fact that the US has not been using landmines, and we all know how many operations, how many military operations, how many wars, how many conflicts they've been involved in. The fact that they haven't used them shows that these are not weapons that the US actually needs. There is the area of the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, but the US argues that those are South Korean mines anyway. So I just think it was a lack of leadership, frankly. It would have been possible for the US to sign the treaty. It might have been difficult to get it through Congress. As you know, it's a very high threshold for ratification of a treaty, but it would have been possible for the US to give up those anti-personnel mines. And I think it is deeply regrettable that they haven't done so. But the fact that they don't use them, the fact that they understand that these bring limited military advantages, I think is a plus point. That doesn't yet bring us to the point that we'd like to be where no state uses these. But hopefully one day that will come.
And so now, bringing this conversation back to contemporary Myanmar and looking at where the anti-personnel mines are laws looking at them and treaties are looking at them, some human rights advocacy around Myanmar, they've argued that anti-personnel mines are inherently indiscriminate, and therefore, because of that, the junta's use of them is simply unlawful. But at the same time, your work seems to insist on separating the different legal layers, the treaty law, CCW rules, customary IHL, criminal accountability, et cetera. And so how do you think we should speak about this responsibly? Is it legally accurate to say that anti-personnel mines are inherently unlawful in Myanmar? Or do we need to be more precise and ask which rule is being violated by whom and under what circumstances?
Yes, I think it's definitely the latter, but I should acknowledge that there are people, including very respected, very experienced international humanitarian lawyers who say, yes, they are inherently discriminate weapons. The reason I don't personally subscribe to that view is it is possible to use these weapons discriminately. And the example is one I've just given, the DMZ. There are 2 million or more mines in the DMZ, and there are no civilian casualties because they are marked, fenced, and guarded by military personnel. When we talk under IHL about an inherently indiscriminate weapon, what we're saying is that weapon cannot be used in any way reasonably that would target only soldiers and not civilians. And there are very few weapons that fall within that category. So the emblematic example is a biological weapon. Once it's launched, it can carry on infecting people. It cannot be restrained, for example. If we look at the very early Scud missiles, they could miss by kilometers their target. That is an inherently indiscriminate weapon. Anti-personnel mines are not, but they are so widely used in an indiscriminate manner that their prohibition by treaty was utterly justified and absolutely necessary. And what we need is for all 197 states to join on. We've got 162 after a few withdrawals from some frontline states in the Baltics and so on. But we've still got a way to go, including, of course, with Myanmar, to make the prohibition of anti-personnel mines universal. And that universality is important, not just for the actual responsibility on states, but it's also required for the individual criminal accountability. There was an attempt to include anti-personnel mines, use of anti-personnel mines as a war crime on the statute of the International Criminal Court. And it foundered because one of the state's parties, the Republic of Korea, wants to carry on using anti-personnel mines. We need to get past that so that any use of an anti-personnel mine is a war crime. That's not the situation yet today.
You're placing Myanmar in this global context of treaties and international law, and I had referenced the so-called high watermark of just a couple decades ago. And when we look at the successes of the mine ban treaty, it seems to be under real political stress now. There are some European states that are moving towards withdrawal, and Ukraine has raised some controversy over its obligations in the context and justifications in the case of Russia's invasion. Myanmar's not party to the treaty again, but it is one of the places where the human cost of landmines is the most severe. And so I'm curious how you think we should understand where Myanmar fits into this wider moment. Do you see this as mainly a non-party problem, a customary IHL problem, perhaps a non-state armed group issue? Or is this going towards a trend or a sign that the global norm against anti-personnel mines itself could be weakening?
I'm not sure it's weakening, but there have certainly been stresses. As you rightly mentioned, states have withdrawn from the convention over the last year. The three Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, plus Poland, plus Finland. That is deeply regrettable, and it certainly does not strengthen the norm. That said, just in the last few days, we've had Lebanon that has joined the convention. Lebanon, a state that is embroiled in an armed conflict, an ongoing armed conflict that has foreign troops on its territory and has nonetheless taken the decision to join the convention. That, I think, shows that it is possible to join the convention to strengthen the norm without giving up your right to self-defense. So stresses, yes, certainly not a problem. Where there are two problems, one of them you've mentioned, Ukraine. Ukraine is seriously violating the Anti-Personnel Mine Man Convention, and it is deeply regrettable and frankly shocking that this has not been called out more than it has. That's a reflection of where Ukraine stands. In many ways, they have complied with IHL. This is a very notable and a very regrettable exception. The second problem is we've seen a recrudescence of non-state armed groups using, producing anti-personnel mines. Islamic State, for example, produced mines on an industrial scale when it was in control of parts of Syria and Iraq. That is deeply regrettable. We've seen the Houthis in Yemen producing, using anti-personnel mines. That trend has reversed what I think was a very clear trend over 20 years towards far fewer mines being placed in the ground, and as a result, far fewer casualties. Myanmar, sadly, has remained outside the treaty, outside the convention on certain conventional weapons, and the use by the Tatmadaw and by certain rebel groups, but particularly the use by the Myanmar military, has been indiscriminate. They have committed war crimes through their use of anti-personnel mines. In certain instances, they have forced people to walk through minefields. That is a war crime. That kind of conduct is beyond any rule of IHL, and hopefully one day those who are responsible will be brought to account.
And you bring up this important point of what happens with non-state actors, which is obviously extremely relevant when we're looking in the case of Myanmar. And I'm curious how international law deals with armed actors who are not straightforward treaty-making states. For example, if the Ottawa Treaty formally binds the states that have joined it, where are the obligations that still apply to non-state armed groups under IHL specifically? And practically speaking, what levers exist, if any, really, to influence their behavior, whether through customary law, Geneva call commitments, humanitarian engagement, documentation, maybe even donor pressure, or the possibility, threat, let's say, of future accountability?
One of the strengths of international humanitarian law is precisely that it applies to all parties to armed conflict, whether that party is a state armed force, whether that party is a non-state armed group. And if you use any weapon, whether it's anti-personnel mines or anything else, if you use that weapon to target civilians, or if you use that weapon in an indiscriminate manner, by which we mean not targeted against a legitimate military objective, you are potentially committing a war crime and you can be held accountable. And on the basis of universal jurisdiction, a war crime can be prosecuted by any country in the world, even if the unlawful conduct took place thousands of miles away and many years ago. That's one of the strengths. It means that today we are seeing those in the Syrian regime being put on trial for what they did back in 2011, back in 2012. Justice is slow, but in certain circumstances, it will come. And that applies whether it's a state or official or a member of a non-state armed group. They can all be held accountable, and hopefully those prosecutions for unlawful acts, including using anti-personnel mines, will take place in years to come.
One of the interesting things that I was coming across as I was doing research for this interview was this idea of treaty stigma. And as I came to break that down, and as I came to understand it, it involved this sense of the culture that was created around norms that in some cases may not carry, in some contexts, actual legal ramifications, but were influencing culture and ways of thought. And so this was advantageous even in places where treaties may not cover, there was a treaty stigma that was there. But my question is, as we're looking at this decline in a rules-based order and the withdrawal from some in of the Ottawa Treaty, I'm wondering if you're seeing treaty stigma as depending on a broader respect for international law that's already being in place. In other words, if the global rule of law environment is eroding first and faster, if states and armed actors increasingly ignore, attack, or relativize international law, as we're also seeing examples of, does that then weaken the stigma that the mind ban treaty is supposed to create? And for a non-party state like Myanmar, where the treaty's direct legal force is limited, at least from that treaty, what happens when the wider legal culture that's surrounding it that gives the stigma its power is already breaking down?
You're absolutely right. These are difficult times for international humanitarian law, for international law more broadly. I think we should recognize that there was never a golden age for the laws of war. There have been violations always. We go back decades and we've seen them. There was, I think, a hope. You've mentioned the 90s, and I think that's an important period. But I would also add into the 2010s. I think we saw a move that there was a desire to continue to reduce the impact on civilians through the use of precision-guided munitions targeted only against military objectives, for example. I think there was a hope that we were actually moving in a positive direction. But the realities with Islamic State, the realities with the position of the United States today have meant that that is under serious threat. And I would not underplay or underestimate the dangers of norm erosion, which is why those of us who believe that this is progress, that protecting civilians is important, I think need to argue our case ever more strongly. It is clear, I think, that the Myanmar government will not join the anti-personnel mine ban treaty in any near future. But hopefully, when a democratic government that reflects the desires, the aspirations, and the protection of everyone in Myanmar comes into power, that will be one of their first acts, because the well-being, the protection of civilians is always enhanced by being a state party to the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention.
And I'm also contrasting the backdrop, the historical backdrop you gave, both of a figure of Lady Diana's significance and her personal moral decision to want to take this on. And it's really heartening to hear it wasn't that it wasn't just capturing media coverage, but in the case of its influence in the UK, you know, that's a very profound thing to point to that can't be underestimated. And also looking at Canada and Norway and other countries at the time and where they wanted to lead to do the right thing. And there was really a push for this. And you contrast that with today, where in both of those cases, whether you're looking at somewhat of a celebrity or a person that is using their influence in the world to be able to advance a cause they care about, or whether you're looking at a dynamic leader in a within a country or a country itself, it seems from an outsider's point of view, it certainly seems like there is less of this than was happening back at that time, and that this is, in some ways, I'd almost say this is fallen out of fashion. When there is a person of prominence or a country that is trying to lead the way, I tend to, especially with the rise of social media, you tend to see a lot of mocking, you know, of those values in some degree. And so and as we've seen with the rise of China and Russia, and certainly the Trump administration and the transactional nature that we see there, I just get a general sense that a lot of these values are just at the moment falling out of fashion. And, you know, things go in ebbs and flows. And we've had conversations on this platform that have tried to determine how much of this is an ebb and a flow that's going to change back and how much of it is a new norm. But I would imagine that in the context of the work you're doing, this must be certainly challenging and somewhat disheartening in a way, this era that we're now in.
It's certainly disheartening. There would be no two ways about it. We've seen what happened in Gaza. We've seen what's happening in Sudan. We're seeing what's happening in Lebanon. We're seeing what's happening in Myanmar and many others. And it's impossible not to see that as not just disheartening, but horrific, frankly, the level of atrocity that's being committed. I would just say that in humanity's darkest times, we have had, at least in the past, we have had statesmen that have come forward. And let me give you a couple of examples in relation to weapons. The Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962, where we almost came to oblivion, was followed by the Partial Test Ban Treaty to stop detonating nuclear weapons in the atmosphere and poisoning us for generations to come. A few years later, it led to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to prevent what then President-elect John Kennedy was saying was the nth country problem, that we were going to have dozens of countries with nuclear weapons, and sooner or later, we were going to have more detonations. And then in the 1980s, when again we almost came to oblivion during Operation Able Archer, the Petrov incident, we got the INF Treaty, which removed short and intermediate range nuclear missiles. So that was a long kind of summary. But what I'm suggesting is, at our darkest times, we can make new law and we can make protective law. I just hope that those statesmen, stateswomen, can step forward and show that this is not just historical, but this is present.
And to put that little bit of optimism and light in further in that direction, you pointed in already in this interview to Syria as an example where documentation of human rights and IHL violations eventually led to these prosecutions in Europe, including cases against members of the Assad regime who actually sought asylum there. At the same time, you know, we have to acknowledge these cases are tiny compared to the scale of the crimes committed. But that being said, it also shouldn't be overlooked, and especially in the great despair, I think, that many feel at this current time in Myanmar over 5 years into the crisis. Just using that little bit of light to Syria as an example, how should people in Myanmar, what should people in Myanmar take from that? And how should we think about the value of documentation where justice may be delayed, it may be partial, it may be far smaller than the harm itself, but it's still not meaningless?
It's never meaningless. And it's critical that incidents, data, video, interviews, all of this information can lead to prosecutions later on. Let's not forget that, okay, it took many years, but Charles Taylor is in prison. Radovan Karadzic is in prison. Ratko Mladic is in prison. Justice can and sometimes does catch up with you even many years afterwards. I realize that that is very scant consolation to those who are living through atrocities today. But it is a little bit of hope that the future, whether it be 1, 5, 10 years from now, the future will be better and that there will be some accountability. It will never be perfect. It will never bring back those who have been killed and tortured and raped and injured. But it will, I hope, help to deter future leaders, future people from committing similar atrocities.
And certainly you, among others that we've spoke to on this platform, and many that we haven't, are gathering that evidence. They're doing that work, looking towards that future day of the wheels of justice running slowly, but still running nonetheless, as we're reminded. And part of that work is, as we've pointed to, again, the documentation and documentation according to specific legal frameworks. And this is where I want to bring one other technical term in that is very relevant in terms of how things are documented and understood. And that is two basic principles of international humanitarian law, distinction and proportionality. And I'm curious how these two principles apply specifically to anti-personnel mines, especially given, as we've mentioned, they may remain active long after they're placed and cannot choose between a combatant and a civilian. And in the Myanmar context in particular, where there's been widespread reporting of mines being placed in or around homes, schools, religious sites, other civilian spaces, how we should think about that legally in terms of these two features, and at what point the use of landmines moves from really a terrible humanitarian reality in the context of war to a clear violation of IHL that, as you say, could come in 1, 5, or 10 years as these things are being documented.
Absolutely right. Those are the two fundamental principles of the law of armed conflict that regulates what we call the conduct of hostilities, i.e. The fighting. But in this particular case, I think we can leave proportionality to one side. Not that it's not important, because it most assuredly is, but I would say it's distinction where we need to focus our efforts. So where a mine was placed, as you said, at a school or by a water point or by someone's home or in a field without any military utility, that's not just a violation of the principle of distinction, it's very likely to be a war crime. And that war crime can be prosecuted in any country in the world that decides to do so, and it can be prosecuted many years to come. To give you an example, again, sorry, it's not from Myanmar, it's this time it's to do with Iraq, but we recently put together an expert opinion for the British police, because they will be prosecuting an individual that is alleged to have committed a war crime in as a member of Islamic State 10 years ago. 10 years is a long time to wait for justice, but he sought asylum in the United Kingdom. He was identified as a member, and hopefully the prosecution will proceed. And yes, it's a tiny drop in the ocean, but it is nonetheless a very important drop in the ocean. And that principle applies exactly to the use of landmines when they're targeted against civilians or civilian objects.
And that relates as well with a concept that we brought up early on, which was the time between deployment and detonation. And in your work, you've cited examples of where responsibility did not depend only on proving the exact moment of deployment. I'm thinking, for example, of the case of the Turkish prosecution involving negligent landmine deployment, and a European human rights case where Russia was found to have failed to protect civilians from landmine danger in Chechnya, even though it was unclear who had laid the mines. And so I'd like to invite you to flesh out these cases as far as is relevant to Myanmar, and to tell us what this teaches us about future accountability and documentation for landmines. When the person who placed the mine cannot be clearly identified as well, what legal duties may still remain around warnings, markings, investigation, clearance, and civilian protection alongside with that?
Yes. So the Turkish case is a very simple one. It was a Turkish commander that either ordered or allowed the use of an anti-personnel mine, and Turkey was at the time a state party to the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention. So it was the mere fact of use, irrespective of who it was used against, it was the mere fact of use that was the commission of the crime. The second example that you give is a very interesting one, because it concerned, just as you said, it was unclear whether it was the Russian forces or the Chechens who had originally placed the anti-personnel mine, but there is an obligation under the right to life to protect life, to do everything is reasonable, what we call due diligence, to do everything reasonable to protect civilians, which could be clearance, or at least until clearance is possible, to fence and mark an area. And the Russians did not do this. And the Russians were not and are not a state party to the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention. So there was a possibility through a human rights court, the European Court of Human Rights, to find Russia responsible. More difficult in Myanmar, of course, because you don't have that regional human rights court, but there is still the possibility through the human rights treaty bodies to have some measure of responsibility. It will be challenging. It would be wrong to suggest otherwise. But the international criminal law route for war crimes committed using anti-personnel mines, that route remains open. And if a member of the Tatmadaw, a senior official in the Myanmar government, travels in years to come to one of many countries that have legislation for war crimes or crimes against humanity, because that can also be a prosecution of the use of an anti-personnel mine, then there is the possibility for accountability.
We mentioned earlier in the conversation this issue of stockpiles. You referenced this early on when you were speaking about how a temptation can be taken away from using a type of weaponry, even going back to, again, like crossbow or poison, that simply not having it protects against an inclination to want to use it. And so when we look at the issue of stockpiles when it comes to landmines, production and selling them and storing them, the mine ban treaty, as we've talked about, it's not just about use. It does deal with stockpiling, transfer, production, and destruction of anti-personnel mines. But again, we keep coming back to Myanmar's case, where we're talking about a country that's outside the treaty, and certainly is reported to have stockpiles of landmines. And so is there any way that we can understand the legal importance of stockpiles in a place like Myanmar, which is outside of the treaty's boundaries? And are there changes when we look at not just where mines are laid, but where they, if we start getting into, and I don't know to what extent your work has gone into this, but where they're from, who holds them, how they move, and where that then comes to obligations of future accountability, questions around their destruction.
So if Myanmar does not join the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention, then there will not be a prohibition on production or stockpiling. That's sadly the reality, the legal reality in which we live. But if there are other states that are supplying Myanmar with anti-personnel mines, then it's a slightly different situation. Let's take, for example, the position with respect to China. And China is a state party to the Arms Trade Treaty. It's not a state party to the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention, but it is a state party to the Arms Trade Treaty. That means it is bound not to transfer conventional weapons to any regime that would use them for war crimes or crimes against humanity, or where there would be a clear risk that they were used to facilitate or commit a serious violation of international humanitarian law. Those are obligations that I hope China takes very seriously, and so would other states that are party to the Arms Trade Treaty. So even though they have not joined the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention, there are other rules of international law that can influence the behavior of exporting states.
And when we're looking at the issue of landmines, we've touched upon it a little bit in the background, but to bring it to the foreground is, where, when landmines are placed, to what degree they're assignage, to what degree it is marked, where that responsibility comes in. And I want to ask that question specifically around the case of children, because we have spoken to several people on this platform, several Burmese that are doing work in Myanmar on it, and have talked about the devastating impact of where children come in to not understanding landmines and getting harm from them, from playing, from just being curious. And we've spoken to guests who've talked about different kinds of advocacy that's geared intentionally towards educational and warning about the risks of children to be careful as they go out and about. In Myanmar, where children are not just these occasional victims of explosive ordnance, they're central to this civilian population that's most exposed to these risks. Again, through plain or curiosity, but also, in the case of rural Myanmar, we've heard stories about collecting firewood or walking on certain paths or returning to contaminated areas. When we look at where IHL then comes to the particular vulnerability that children represent, is there anything about the presence of children in an area that changes how one may think about the precautions, the warnings, that the signage that needs to be there, or even, this is probably outside IHL, but risk education and victim assistance? And then when children do get injured or tragically killed by weapons that could have been placed there sometime earlier.
So there is a provision for risk education And a particular concern with children, again, that's in the anti-personnel mine ban convention. So not something that's binding directly on Myanmar. What I would say is that in terms of victims of landmines, already when there is displacement, which is obviously a big issue in Myanmar, when there is displacement of anyone, then the risks are heightened. When it's displaced children, those risks are heightened even further. You've rightly said that there may not be the knowledge of the dangers of playing with items that are unfamiliar, some of which will be explosive. And then the other thing, which is, I guess, is the toughest one, is when you see a 5-6-year-old boy or girl who has had their leg blown off in excruciating pain. They will then face a lifetime of prosthetic limbs. And particularly when they're young, those prosthetic limbs need to be changed about once every 6 months. That means there has to be a functioning physical rehabilitation process, which very often is not the case. And as I understand it, is very much not the case in the context of Myanmar. So they are at greater risk of being injured. And then when they are injured by these weapons, they are at greater risk of being victimized, and not just for years, but for decades. Mm.
It's so tragic, this part of it. And obviously the whole field is, and that's why you have been involved to the extent that you have. And I want to remind listeners that who have been listening to our landmine, are navigating the landmine series, that that Myanmar is now has the distinction of having more landmines than any other country in the world. And that of the 330 townships that are in Myanmar, as of October 2025, there has been landmine ERW contamination that's been reported in 211 of them. So we are talking about really a dire situation that we want to highlight and bring to attention.
And no clearance. And that's in most countries, even where mines are still being laid, even where they've not joined the convention, there is ongoing clearance. For example, in Ukraine, many millions of mines, probably the most affected country in the world in just terms of numbers of anti-personnel mines, but there is clearance going on. That clearance is not happening in Myanmar. And at the very least, humanitarian organizations should be allowed in to clear anti-personnel mines where there is no military benefit. It is just the civilian population that are at risk. I hope that in the months and years to come, that will be something to prevent ever more numbers of civilians being killed or injured by these weapons.
It's a critical point to bring, and I'm so glad you did bring that up, because again, we've discussed this with previous guests and how it is strongly encouraged by experts that normal civilians would not even attempt to go anywhere near the clearance that's required, just the technical skills and the obvious danger. And yet there's a situation where, because clearance is not allowed to take place, sometimes civilians have been forced into just unimaginable circumstances of having to do the unthinkable, because, as you say, without clearance, we're looking at the most contaminated country as of now that is only moving more in the plus column, and the only thing coming from the minus column is when these are triggered and they take human or animal victims. And so to ask the obvious question, but just to get your answer on the record, and maybe think more specifically in directions that may not occur to us, what are the implications of a country with this degree of contamination that is literally growing by the day of that contamination, without subtraction of the total number, and no possibility of clearance at the moment, no foreseeable possibility in the future of having clearance operations? What is that telling us for long-term implications? And are there historical precedents that we could look at that would be similar to how this is playing out now?
Well, sadly, and I wish I could give better news, but sadly, this is a problem that will plague Myanmar and the Burmese for decades to come. Even if the war were to stop tomorrow, even if Myanmar were to join the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention tomorrow, which, as we know, is not going to happen, even if that were to occur, you would still be clearing anti-personnel mines from Myanmar at the end of this century. That's the level of devastation that is being caused. But every mine that is cleared is a limb or a life saved. So whenever clearance is possible, and it will be possible one day, whenever it's possible, it should start. The international community should pour in money. Whoever is in charge in Myanmar should join the treaty. And at the very least, the most hazardous areas for civilians could be addressed within a certain period of time, a few years, at most a decade. That wouldn't clear all the mines. That wouldn't stop the deaths and the injuries, but it would vastly reduce it. And the reality is, we saw after the convention was adopted in 1997, even in countries that still had very large numbers of mines on their territory in place, the number of casualties came down because there was no new use and clearance was focusing on humanitarian priorities. So you can, even though you can't get rid of the problem within many decades, you can reduce the civilian impact within a relatively short period of time.
And to perhaps state more of the obvious, or perhaps for those that are not in this context, it may not be obvious, but there, with the degree of landmine contamination, we're seeing the reverberations of consequences this had is catastrophic. You're looking at a country that has massive food insecurity for all kinds of reasons. And that food insecurity is further heightened by the fact that there are landmines across fields where food could be grown that then can't be accessed and harvested. You're looking at in places where one would want to, where so-called liberated zones, or where there's a break in conflict, where civil society in some degree, you know, health, education, governance, some of this could be coming back from the ground up, but where there are landmines again, this hampers that development. And then to say nothing of the enormous psychological and emotional strain that this causes of the fear, the danger that's always with you, that's literally underfoot, and the proximity of those that of now a growing number of people knowing someone that was harmed or lost their life to landmines, this being a something that's existing just on the periphery of that psyche, and probably more implications beyond even what I'm describing. So the multifaceted way this is detrimental to all aspects of society, it really just can't be overestimated.
No, that's absolutely correct. And it is that broader societal impact, economic impact, that sets, I would say, landmines apart from other weapons. All weapons, all war wounds are horrible, but it is that broader societal impact that I think means that the effects of these weapons will be felt for many years to come, even after Myanmar has joined the states that are party to the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention. The day they do, however, resources will flood in. States will be keen to help. There are plenty of expert demining organizations, NGOs, that have the capacity to mark, to clear, to survey, and to reduce the humanitarian impact. So as desperate as the situation is, and it clearly is desperate, it can get better.
And so here I would like to close by zooming out a little on your overall work and then where Myanmar fits into it, because your career has put you in almost every stage of these processes we're speaking about. You've researched the effects of war on children, helped shape the diplomatic processes around weapons treaties, as we mentioned, worked on the Mine Ban Convention, and tracked implementation through landmine monitoring, and then turned that experience into legal scholarship and commentary. And so with this, I want to ask you, from that very long view, how are you seeing international law actually changing the behavior of armed actors? Because I think we've gone through some pretty dark times and pessimist takes. And so I'd like to close with a bit of light here, or whatever light reality can allow. And when you're looking at where some of these positive changes could come in, do you see it coming from the treaties themselves, the stigmas that they create, the monitoring, the threats of accountability, humanitarian pressure, or some combination of all of those things or more that I haven't mentioned here?
I think it is clear that treaties can and do save lives. Now, I'm an international lawyer, so I obviously have a particular vista on that. But the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention is a very good example where, I said right at the start, there are tens of thousands of men, women, and children who are still alive, who still have legs and arms because of that treaty. The numbers with respect to Convention on Cluster Munitions are not as big, but they are nonetheless significant. 50 million anti-personnel mines were destroyed, stockpiles were destroyed by states parties to the Anti-Personnel Mine Convention. That's a lot of saved limbs. Where I would see progress for the future, obviously we want Myanmar and all other states to join those treaties, but I think there's a glaring absence in that treaty framework, and that is on small arms. We have to limit the proliferation of small arms and light weapons, and we have to do a much better job of it than we've done now. Treaties can and do save lives. That, I guess, is the optimistic message I would hope. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to return to asking about the human side of this work. You've personally spent your life dealing with weapons that leave civilians dead, injured, displaced, afraid to merely step out their home, and with legal systems that are moving slowly, partially, or not at all. And basically, you spent a career looking very directly at some of the very worst things that human beings can do to each other, and the slow, imperfect legal systems that are meant trying to respond. And so how have you been able to keep your balance in that? How have you been able to remain clear, useful, even, dare I say, optimistic and human without being devastated by the proximity of what your work entails?
I guess the easy answer is because I can see progress. It may be small. It is certainly imperfect. It is certainly frustrating. But let me just give you an anecdote to explain what I mean by that. So when I first started working on, I was helping the then coordinator of this new campaign against anti-personnel mines that was set up in 92. I joined in 93, and I went to the press pack in the United Nations in Geneva. And I said, look, I'm representing the international campaign to ban landmines, and we're going to try and prohibit these weapons. And the journalists in the room laughed at me. They laughed at this naive youngster who really didn't know how the world worked. 4 years later, 122 states signed a treaty prohibiting anti-personnel mines. That shows you, as cynical, as depressed as we can be, there is always the opportunity for progress. And that is, I think, what pushes us all on.
In a world where Myanmar's crisis has largely faded from the headlines, critical voices and perspectives are often left unheard. And that's where we hope to come in. Through this humble platform, we're trying to provide something unique, an opportunity to share important experiences, insights, struggles, and perspectives in depth and in a way that few other media sources offer. Our content not only keeps the sputtering global conversation about Myanmar alive, but it also brings much-needed attention to those now fighting for their freedom and dignity. So if you value this work and the perspectives we're offering, please consider supporting us. Your contributions help us to continue to amplify those voices and provide the world with the coverage Myanmar so desperately deserves. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to stand with us.